So I want to move on now and talk about our next topic, which is targeted therapy. And the other group's going to do EGFR, but I wanted to present a couple cases and sort of go through a bunch of the other ones because there's so much happening now. We're going to start out talking about ALK, and I'm going to let Ben comment on ALK. As you might expect, alectinib now is a first-line therapy for patients with ALK in spite of TPS. I don't know whether, I assume that people are using targeted therapy. I don't know if you all see people who get IOs or chemo IO instead of targeted therapy for high TPS. Ben, can you just comment a little bit about where we are today with first-line therapy? We have brigatinib out there as well. Is that a consideration? And what does TPS mean in a patient with a target mutation, for example, ALK? And what does it mean in terms of benefits from checkpoint inhibitors?
I think that clearly we've got data in the first line, both with alectinib and brigatinib in the ALEX and the ALTA trials, respectively. You know, the most mature data we have is with alectinib, with seeing a median PFS versus crizotinib, PFS, not OS, of close to 32 to 34 months. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. That's not overall survival, that's PFS. And I think for these reasons, the more mature data, given the improvement in PFS that we've seen, given the intracranial activity of this drug, and the response rates north of 60 to 70% in the brain, alectinib is a standard. I think brigatinib has also been compared to crizotinib. We don't have as mature data, I believe. Maybe we've had some updates recently, but we've seen a PFS numerically that is not as robust as the ALEX trial with alectinib. Both are reasonable options, but I think alectinib seems to be the first line preferred choice. I think the big question is, what do you do next? And we're still wrestling with optimal options post-alectinib, and of course, and do you do biopsies, liquid or tissue, and then how does that inform treatment decisions with lorlatinib or not, another next-generation ALK drug? Now, one quick parting shot about PD-L1. I think that what we've learned in retrospective data, at least, is that patients with ALK rearrangements generally don't respond at least to single-agent immunotherapy. We have the immunotarget data out of France, a very large study looking at response rates to single-agent immunotherapy for ALK rearranged lung cancer, and it generally does not elicit meaningful responses. So I think that immunotherapy combinations may play a role at some point, and I think there's emerging trials that are looking at this, but at least single-agent immunotherapy is off the table for me, and I think we need to optimize sequencing TKIs for patients with ALK rearranged lung cancer.
So, John, we asked people about, in general, where they're going to use IOs in patients with ALK, and I think probably other targetable lesions as well. It's certainly down the line a little bit. One of the things I've heard I'm not really clear about, John, is that there's some patients, particularly with ALK that I've heard, I think Ross Kamage was telling me about this, that have high PD-L1 levels but don't respond the way you would expect high PD-L1. Any comments on that, John, in terms of kind of what's going on there?
Yeah, we don't know exactly about that population and whether that should drive you towards using immunotherapy. We have some data from EGFR that's somewhat similar. Justin Gaynor put this data together, looking at EGFR mutant patients who had high PD-L1. And even if they had high PD-L1, their outcomes were significantly worse than patients that did not have a driver mutation that had high PD-L1. So it looks like in the presence of a driver mutation, even if you have high PD-L1, immunotherapy doesn't work great. It has some activity. So that's why I put it after platinum doublet as well as TKIs further down the road. Now, the reason for that is thought to be at least in part lower tumor mutation burden. So perhaps the high PD-L1s are the ones that have a little bit higher tumor mutation burden. But there may also be mechanisms where ALK and EGFR are actively suppressing the immune system.
So I have to say, I got to ask you, John, to tell the group what you were telling me about. You mentioned EGFR mutated. I've got to bring this up because it just was so interesting to me. John made the analogy between EGFR mutated lung cancer and renal cell cancer. Have you heard that one, Ben?
I haven't. I'd love to hear it now.
I asked Corey Langer the other day if he ever heard of it. No. So, John, I never heard of it. Nobody heard, but I think it's amazing. Can you explain it to them?
Yeah, and I guess part of this is connecting some publications that are out there, and there's something we've presented at meetings that will hopefully be coming out soon. So EGFR mutants actually, as part of their activation, constitutively drive a pathway called the HIF-1 alpha pathway. Now, HIF-1 alpha hypoxia-inducible factor is normally get what's turned on in hypoxia. So in the center of a tumor where there's poor vessels going in, hypoxia gets turned in, these VEGF gets turned on and so forth. But in the case of EGFR mutants, this pathway is turned on all the time in all the cells, whether they're hypoxic or not. In fact, EGFR mutant tumors, they often have this lipidic growth in the lung. They're actually less hypoxic than most tumors. And now the other tumor that's similar to this is actually kidney cancer. So kidney cancer has a different mutation. There they've got VHL mutation that leads to HIF being constitutively active. In fact, Bill Kalin just got the Nobel Prize last year for uncovering this, how VHL activates the HIF-1 alpha pathway, for uncovering this biology with Greg Zemenza and John Ratcliffe. So the reason this actually came to us, we had reported earlier about the EGFR mutants driving the HIF-1 alpha pathway. There's a paper a number of years ago, Li Xu is the first author, and others have observed that as well. When we were doing gene expression analyses of EGFR mutant, we thought they were going to be similar to HER2 amplified breast and other oncogene driven tumors, but actually what they came out to be most similar to was renal cell. So we think that for the same reasons that renal cell responds robustly to VEGF inhibitors, we think EGFR mutant does the same.
I thought that was super cool. And I guess the other thing I was wondering about after you mentioned that, John, is, you know, in renal cell and other thing, you know, endometrial cancer, you're seeing VEGF TKIs plus IO. So you have like pembro axitinib, for example, with renal cell. Is that being looked at in lung?
Yeah, so we've had a couple of trials taking a look at that. Now, here the problem is that several of them have led to more pneumonitis. And in the case of osimertinib with immunotherapy, and that would be a natural, osimertinib is such a good drug in the first-line setting, there seemed to be an increased incidence of hepatitis seen when you combined immunotherapy with osimertinib. So, you know, it doesn't tell us that the biology is wrong at combining immunotherapy with EGFR inhibitors, but there may be toxicities. Now, for the VEGF inhibitors, we do have combinations now with bevacizumab and osimertinib, bevacizumab and erlotinib, and ramucirumab with both of those too. The RELAY study was ramucirumab with erlotinib. That showed a significant benefit in that study, a PFS difference of about 7 months, and maybe FDA approved in the near future. It got a positive vote from ODAC.
You know, I'm out there with all the general oncologists listening to all this stuff, trying to figure out, as it come together, I guess. The other thing that's kind of interesting about IO angiogenic is, you know, the atezo-bev combination that just came out with hepatocellular cancer, that's first-line therapy immediately. And so, you know, similar principle, but we'll see where that goes. And just to finish out on that, John, I guess it also, we're going to talk with the other group, but I was curious from this group about the issue of EGFR plus anti-angiogenic. And I know there are trials going on there right now. Just kind of curious, Leora, is that a strategy you ever consider? Somebody's progressing to OC, add Bev, or, you know, that kind of a, or even start up front with that kind of a strategy?
I've tried to add it, and I hear people say they see responses. I have not seen any patients respond. I don't start up front because, again, it comes back to quality of life. Who wants to come back every 3 weeks for an infusion? It's going to make you a little bit more tired. It's going to bump up your blood pressure, and eventually you're going to get proteinuria because you're on these drugs for such a long time. I think that for that to become a good strategy is to find an oral VEGF TKI that we can combine. Unfortunately, they tried that with afatinib and entetinib, and that was just toxic, but it's probably because of the EGFR inhibitor more than entetinib. And, you know, if we can come up with a good oral-oral combo, I think I'll get excited about it. But while we're using an IV and oral, why come in every 3 weeks when you could come in every 3 months?
Particularly nowadays.